Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Little Beirut, as George Herbert Walker Bush used to call the People's Republic of Portland, Oregon. Welcome to our program, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, on AirAmericaRadio.com, WhiteRoseSociety.org, RadioPower.org, CRN Digital. Don Alexander is the author of Darnia's Quest, what's represented as a Christian alternative to Harry Potter. His website, Darnia's Quest, D-A-R-N-I-A-S, Quest, Q-U-E-S-T.com. Don, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Don, I haven't read the book. I put that, you know, right up front. But my understanding of it is that although it's characterized as a Christian alternative to Harry Potter, the words Jesus or Christ don't appear in it. Am I wrong?
Yes. The words Jesus and Christ do appear in it. I wouldn't say they appear, often as you would see in other religious books. So, to help.
But it's basically not an evangelical book. It's an adventure story.
Well, the main character is very evangelical in his spirit, and one of his primary goals is to see everybody come to a knowledge of Jesus Christ as their Savior. So I would be misrepresenting if I said it didn't. It sure does, but it does mm-hmm. it so in such a way that, you know, it's not out in your face, but more so he lives it through his life, you know.
I see. Well, that's, you know, I find, in my opinion, that's the essence of Christianity is to live it.
Yeah.
You know, by their works they shall be known and all that. But
yes.
I'm curious, you... the news release that we got from you, from your bookers, you know, the folks who are trying to get you on radio shows and TV and whatnot, suggest that without religion, morality is not possible. And I'm curious if without religion, without revealed religion, that is, you know, religions where God spoke to somebody and then that somebody came along and said, here's what God said. I'm curious, if that's the case, how did the human race make it this far? How did we survive all these years?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, as Christians, we probably agree without Christ, morality isn't possible. You know, I mean, I don't know about you, but my relationship with Christ is utmost. And, in John 15:5, it says, he's the vine, we're the branches, and he who abides in him bears much fruit, for without me you can do nothing. So
I don't disagree with that basic premise, but I also don't need, you know, and speaking as a Christian, I know, you know, long before I read the Ten Commandments, I knew it was wrong to kill.
Right, right. And I think that comes with our conscience, you know, that God-given conscience, you know.
Well, so what part of morality do we need religion for? And again, let me just say right up front, I'm not an opponent of religion. You know, I consider myself a religious person. But why try to make the argument? I mean, the argument that I make in favor of religion is that it meets a fundamental human need, that there is, the, you know, built into us the ability to experience the divine, the extraordinary. For some people, it's looking up at the night sky and just going, oh, you know. For some people, they find it in nature. For some people, they find it in a particular religion. For some people, they find it in prayer. For some people, they find it in relationships. And some people tragically find that need met in distorted ways through the abuse of drugs or you know, getting lost in our modern culture. But the thing that I don't get is why any particular revealed religion is necessary for morality.
Okay, and I'm going to tip off that with a scripture in Psalms. It says in Psalm 103:11, for as high as the heavens are above the earth, so great is his love for those who fear him. As far as the east is from the west, so far as he removed our transgressions from us. We serve such a God of love, and we've been thinking about the theme of love with the movie of Brokeback Mountain, which, of course, I'm dead set against because of the morality issue there. But you know, Tom, I think to answer your question, it's such a I think we need to differentiate between. In fact, I think the Lord is doing that in this day and age, between a Christian who is a Christian in name only versus a Christian who has been born again and one who has said, "I surrender all to you, Lord." And I think as far as morality goes, I mean, I think you mentioned the Ten Commandments, and my goodness, what an awesome thing you mentioned. You know, we've got to get back to that in our country, to the Ten Commandments. You know, that's one of the main
things. So you think that we should be stoning children to death for speaking ill of their parents?
Whoa, where did that come from?
It's in Deuteronomy. I'm assuming you've read the Bible.
Oh, I got you, yeah.
It's right there in the Ten Commandments.
Right, right. And I think that would, you know, of course be inappropriate. I mean, you know...
Then you're opposed to the Ten Commandments.
Well, I think, you know, when you look at the Levitical laws, you know, and Jesus did say that he came to fulfill the law, and I see what you're saying. You know, we live in a different time and age, and yet Jesus Christ...
Well, what I'm saying is it sounds to me like, you know, you're trying to have it two ways. You know, for example, you were talking about homosexuality. I don't recall, and I really and truly, Don, have read the entire Bible four times in my life, and you know, I'm not just talking off the top of my head here. I don't find any reference to homosexuality in the words of Jesus in the New Testament, and the references that I find to it in the Old Testament are nowhere near as severe as the penalties that are prescribed for people who, for example, wear clothing made out of two different kinds of fabric or who eat shellfish.
Well, I know you know in Leviticus that it says that, you know, homosexuality is an abomination to the Lord, and again in Isaiah it says that as well, and yeah, in Matthew Jesus.
And it's an abomination to the Lord to eat shellfish, and it's an abomination to the Lord to marry somebody of another religion, and it's an abomination to the Lord to bring them in and have them as slaves in your household, and you know, I mean, the list goes on and on. There's over 600 specific in Leviticus. There's over 600 specific instructions, many of which carry the death penalty that go way beyond the Ten Commandments.
Correct.
And homosexual behavior is included in that lump. Why just pick out that one? Why not go on a crusade against people wearing Dacron and cotton?
Well, you know, there you go. And you know,
that's illegal according to the Bible.
You know, Corinthians does say that we know in part and we prophesy in part, and when that which has come, you know, one of the things I don't want anybody to misunderstand with me is I'm not coming out against everybody. I feel Jesus said it best when he said in John 15, this is my command, love one another, you know, and we'll only know, Tom, you know, when he returns. But at the same time, I like what you're saying about let's search the scriptures and to see which things are
so. So Don, if loving one another is the essence of certainly the New Testament, and I think that we agree on that, you know, Jesus, this is his highest commandment.
Absolutely.
And if somebody is born gay, and I think that's probably the essence of the debate or the disagreement, but we see it in the animal kingdom. You find, you know, right across the line among mammals, which we are one. You know, anywhere from 3 to 8% of mammals will be gay. I mean, it's just, they are. So if somebody is born gay and they are in love with somebody and they're having a long-term monogamous relationship, isn't that far more consistent with biblical teaching than living in agony or not having loving relationships?
Well, I would say that a person isn't born gay, but they're raised gay, and let me clarify there. When my own testimony is I have two friends, one who is a previous gay person and one who is a current gay person, and the one that's a delivered gay person obviously had some inclinations and things growing up and different things, but I think the scripture is very specific about homosexuality. I know a lot of people disagree with me on this, but, you know, if God lists it as an abomination, and you mentioned a lot of the things in Deuteronomy, and they are abominations as well, but Leviticus is very specific, in, as you know, the story of Lot, too, and Sodom and different things, that burning in one's heart for the opposite sex is an abomination to the Lord.
Well, you mentioned Lot. I mean, are you mentioning Lot as a paragon of I mean, you realize, of course, that Lot offered those strangers his two daughters,
right,
who were virgins, and then when he left and his wife turned around and turned to a pillar of stone, he went off and he slept with his two daughters and produced children by them, which became part of the lineage of David that ultimately led to Jesus. I mean, the Bible is not without some strange behaviors in there.
Right, correct. And, you know, I wouldn't list him as a paragon, but I would list him as one that, you know, came back to the Lord, if I'm remembering my scripture correctly, Tom, you know, who was seeking, and like David, who had a looking for a heart for the Lord, and if I remember correctly, he's one of the ones that didn't look back and was, you know, went on, and as Philippians says, I press on toward the goal for the prize of the upward call of God in Christ Jesus. But, yes.
But you know, he never renounced incest.
Yeah, you know, it's things like that, you know. You know, I have no idea. Where, you know, if he ended up...
In the Penguin movie, for example, you know, we find now that penguins are gay. That if a female penguin dies and there's an egg, two male penguins will take care of it, and they behave towards each other affectionately. I mean, this is penguin world. You know?
I believe, you know, this is my belief. I believe that the Lord created us with a love for the opposite sex. I believe that those who are gay are gay.
No, I think it created you and me with that love for the opposite sex.
Well, I think, you know, maybe they came up in a family that was more inclined towards femininity or towards the same sex, you know, and you bring up an excellent point, because if I was brought up in a family that was gay, for example,
I don't think it has anything to do with the family. One of my grandfather's brothers was gay, and you know, that family, I mean, you know, it's just, that's just the way he was from birth.
Yeah, I can't buy that, respectfully. I think that, you know, God gave us our conscience.
Well, this is probably the crux of the disagreement. Anyway, Don Alexander, an interesting conversation. Darnia's Quest, the book, darniasquest.com, the website. Don, good talking with you today.
You too. God bless.
Ditto. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann Program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartmann.
Right-wing freak judges, $200 billion grudges. Yes, war's cooked up right from day one. Big corporations are running this nation like it never was meant to be run. Yes, George, I hope you're having fun.
Indeed. Welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann here with you. Morality. Do we need religion to have morality? In my opinion, no. This is another thing that I think probably separates me from fundamentalists of many religions, and that is that I believe that humans are inherently good, and we don't need somebody telling us what some deity told them about how we should live in order to conduct ourselves well, and that those among us who misbehave are the aberrations, are the aberrants, are the exception to the rule, and I suspect that they believe that we are not just that, you know, we ought for all have sinned and fallen short of the glory, blah de blah, but that we're all essentially evil, and therefore we have to have, you know, powerful forces in our lives that restrain our behavior. And I just, you know, I just don't buy it. I think the natural impulse of humans is to be good. And if it weren't, I don't think the human race would have survived 160,000 years. Or, you know, if you want to be a biblical literalist, 5 or 10,000 years. It just simply wouldn't have made it. And speaking of real morality, this month, in April of 1953, Dwight Eisenhower gave a speech in which he talked about real morality. Here is a Republican President of the United States speaking of what is moral and important.
Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft.
A theft. Every warship launched, every gun that is made signifies, in the final sense, a theft. From whom?
From those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed.
He continues to talk about the giant war machine, the world prepared for war. And keep in mind, this is 1953. I believe that by that time the Korean conflict had been resolved. There was no war, but the world at Cold War. He said, we're not just spending money. There is a very real cost for a battleship. There is a very real cost for a tank. And here. A man who should know. I mean, he was the supreme Allied commander during World War II, a man who devoted his life to the business of fighting wars. President Dwight D. Eisenhower, the true cost of war.
This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this.
Now, get this. The cost of one modern heavy bomber.
a modern brick school in more than 30 cities. It is. 2 electric power plants, each serving a town of 60,000 population. It is. 2 fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is some 50 miles of concrete pavement.
Eisenhower laying out what we could have bought if we didn't buy that one piece of military hardware. He continues.
We pay for a single fighter plane with a 500,000 bushels of wheat. We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people. This is, I repeat, the best way of life to be found on the road the world has been taking. This is not a way of life at all, in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron.
Humanity hanging from a cross of iron. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Lauren in Essex, Vermont. Hey, Lauren, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Well, it's really exciting to talk to you.
Well, and thank you for listening on WBAA there in Burlington.
That's right. I love your show.
Thank you. What's up?
Well, I really liked that the last segment. I thought you're arguing. You're really polite to everybody, and you let everybody have a chance to talk. And your knowledge of the Bible really revealed that this man isn't grounded in the Bible. It's really about a belief that he has that he can't substantiate. That is, that people are born homosexual.
Right. Well, this is the fundamental. With so many of these issues, they always boil down to really one fundamental issue. For example, with the abortion issue, are 4 cells a baby? You know,
right.
People can reasonably disagree on that.
It's a philosophical issue. It's not in the Bible anywhere.
That's right. Absolutely. With regard to abortion, with regard to homosexuality, you know, frankly, I think, you know, the science is pretty irrefutable now that people are born, that some people are born gay. Certainly we know right across the animal kingdom, it is a relatively normal thing.
Well, I thought it was really restrained of you not to say, boy, does Dick Cheney's family seem like what did he say, a feminist or feminized kind of, if you grew up in a feminized environment,
right. Yeah.
You'd be gay. I mean,
well, I don't like to pick on people, and Mary Cheney is, you know, I admire her for being out, you know.
But it's just the you know, ridiculous nature of the argument that you can elicit this from people without getting nasty and calling names and just being knowledgeable about what you're speaking about. I really appreciate that.
Well, thank you, Lauren. Thank you for your kind words and for listening, and be sure to patronize our sponsors.
Okay.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Hey! And welcome back, my friends. 1,021 days. 1,021 days, 12 hours, 27 minutes, 2 seconds until George W. Bush leaves office. Now, it's assuming that there are no interventions on the part of, for example, the House of Representatives with an impeachment attempt, which seems to be on the mind of Tom DeLay.
Now, the DeLay Political...
Whoops.
Now, the DeLay Political Death Watch.
There we go. And Tom DeLay, he's announced that he's leaving. He's leaving the House of Representatives, and he adds...
As difficult as this decision has been for me, it's not going to be a great day for liberal Democrats either. My loyalty to the Republican Party, indeed my love for the Republican Party, has played no small part in this decision. Having served under Republican and Democrat control in the House, I know firsthand how important it is for Republicans to maintain their national majority.
Notice, by the way, that he doesn't say Democratic, which is the actual name of the party. He says Democrat.
A Democrat Congress in 2007 would, without doubt or remorse, raise hundreds of billions of dollars in taxes.
What? We might have a balanced budget? We might stop being in debt? We might stop running up the credit card on our children and grandchildren? Oh, we can't have that. After all, the millionaires and billionaires have to have their tax cuts.
summarily cut and run from the war on terror.
Well, you might get out of Iraq and stop killing our young people and those of Iraq as well? Oh, gee.
And immediately initiate an unconstitutional impeachment of President Bush.
Unconstitutional impeachment. Now, since the impeachment process is in the Constitution, I don't know how it could be unconstitutional. But anyway, facts never really confuse Tom DeLay, right?
However certain such antics might make a Republican resurgence in 2008, the times are too grave to waste even 2 years in the life of this nation and allow even one more vote for their agenda of pessimism and failure.
There you go. And then we get to the real issue. You know, what's really going on here. And that is that Tom DeLay is going to cash in as a lobbyist. He's going to sell his house in Virginia. He's going to move into Washington, D.C., where he can be close to the action and become a multi-millionaire selling influence because he certainly has the connections.
I also intend to relocate my Virginia property and reside closer to Washington so that I can dedicate the necessary time and energy to making a successful transition from the public to private sectors for myself and family.
Yeah, assuming that he doesn't go to jail. That's the strategy. Tom DeLay on his way to becoming a millionaire. Gloria in Plano, Texas. Hey, Gloria, thanks for calling the program.
Hi, Tom. I just had a comment in relation to your last segment.
Mm-hmm.
As to the reason why I think people are born gay. And, I mean, I think it's good now that there's scientific evidence coming forward, but I feel that all you have to do is look at history and look pretty much across all cultures and all time periods. There's been evidence of people being gay.
Mm-hmm.
So pretty much, you know, how can you say it may be because people grew up in a certain type of family when it's been across all kinds of cultures and families and thousands of years? Just the fact that it's in the Bible tells you that homosexuality existed 2,000 years ago.
Right, yeah, it had to exist for them to,
right.
to trash
for
it.
For them to even, exactly, and probably 4,000, 5,000 years ago.
Yeah, no, it's been around as long as humans have been
right,
around.
Right, exactly.
It's been around as long as mammals have been around.
Right, and, so you would tend to think it's some kind, you know, it's a natural thing or something that's ingrained and innate to some people.
Yeah, I agree with you, Gloria, and I think that that's the point of cleavage. And tragically, these mm-hmm. guys are hanging on to this belief,
right.
even in the face of scientific evidence,
right,
which,
exactly.
which is just a shame.
Exactly.
Gloria,
that's my comment for
okay.
today, and hooray about Tom DeLay, but I think you're right, going straight to be a lobbyist.
There you go, straight for the cash.
Yeah.
As soon as he...
yeah, I thought that last night when I heard it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. There you go. Yep.
All right.
Thanks
thank
a lot, Gloria.
Time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Yeah, then the other thing, the reason why he has he's resigning in June or July, whenever it is, sometime this summer, is so that they can, so that Rick Perry, you know, the remnant of the Bush, George W. Bush machine in Texas, Rick Perry can install a Republican in his place so that that Republican will have 4 months of incumbency without even having, you know, had to be beat up in a primary. He'll have 4 months of incumbency to be able to send out franked letters, you know, free mail to everybody in the district and get on the TV constantly and do press conferences and do talk shows locally and all that local campaigning stuff that a candidate would have a much harder time doing and a much more expensive time doing, frankly, you'll be able to do for free. So what DeLay is doing is guaranteeing that that House seat is going to remain Republican, or at least doing the best he can to guarantee that. And he probably actually will be successful in that, would be my guess, because he's just getting out of the way. He's realized how toxic he is. Danny in Iowa City, Iowa. Hey, Danny, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Immigration is on my mind. I just have a quick scenario, and I wanted to ask you what you thought about it. It might be crazy, but okay. Say somehow the Republicans get their way and they build a wall or find out a way to keep out all the illegal immigrants from Mexico. Well, you know, as we know, Mexico is kind of like a fetal state. You know, it's just the oppression is terrible, and the Mexican people, the only hope they have really is El Norte, looking northward. Okay, we cut that off. They're going to be cornered. They're going to turn, and they're going to have to face their government and situation. Well, it's pretty much a dictatorship. We know that. You know, in history, time and time again, has shown us that the people will rise up against this type of oppression, but in some cases, the people take it to the extreme. For example, a communist state like Russia or China or even Castro. So what if what would it be like to have a communist neighbor down south? I mean, is that just taking it too far? I'd like to hear what you think about that. Thanks.
Sure. Yeah, I think it's pretty unlikely, Danny. There actually is right now. Vicente Fox has an opponent in the election that's coming up in June or July, whenever the elections in Mexico are. And the guy is more of a populist. What we're seeing, the direction that we're seeing, much of South America, certainly, we've just seen it in Chile, to some extent in Argentina, certainly in Bolivia, in Venezuela, the directions that we're seeing are people moving in the direction of basically being populists, democratic populists. That is to say, they are, you know, working with the people to try to accomplish the will of the people, you know, to build a society that is fairer for everybody. Mexico's problem is oligarchy. Mexico's problem is that there's a very small number of very, very powerful and wealthy families who basically own the country. And until that is broken up, whether it's through inheritance laws or whether it's through, you know, progressive taxation or what, you know, I don't know how it will be broken up. But until that's broken up, that's the problem that they're going to face. And the reality is that every democratic country, every democracy in the world has come about, at least by and large, I shouldn't say absolutely every, but the vast majority of democratic countries in the world have come about as a result of the people rising up and saying, you know, we want a democracy. We're going to build a democracy. And I suspect that if Mexico wasn't able to export their social pressures to the United States, I mean, we're supplying them with $17 billion a year in foreign aid in the form of repatriated money from illegal workers here in the United States. And also it's a steam release, a pressure release, a release valve, you know, being able to cross the border and come here. I suspect if that didn't exist, that the people of Mexico would, as you say, have to face the problem. And I would hope, and I suspect, that they would face that problem in a reasonable fashion. Pat in Orlando, Florida. Hey, Pat, what's on your mind?
Tom, great show. The Tom DeLay deal. What I heard this morning on C-SPAN was one of the reasons he may be getting out now is because he can use the re-election campaign funds
for his legal defense fund.
Exactly. I think that's outrageous that he could do something like that.
Well, I think that's the reason why he got out now instead of before the primary, because during the primary he raised a lot more money than he spent.
Yes.
And so now he's got, you know, several millions of dollars, my understanding is, in his campaign war chest, and he can use that. But once you're no longer running for office, there's these strange rules in the House of Representatives. You can actually use that money personally.
Yes.
And there are some restrictions on it, but not many. And he certainly can use it for his legal defense. Although I suspect that he'll probably use it to open his lobbying business, and he's got lots of good friends who will help out with his legal defense. But
that could be also. I also got a kick out of the fact that he had a term there in his little speech about the Democrats and all this, and you know, negative about the Democrats, which reminded me of the time he had to report into the sheriff's office in Texas, where he had a big smile on his face.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's all going to come back and bite him really hard on his ass when reality hits him. Hopefully, they might give him a few years or something. But you need.
Well, just to give credit where credit's due, that smile was a pretty smart trick on his part, actually, because he knew that a mugshot is in the public domain. You know, it's a public document. And so he knew that that was going to be picked up by newspapers and media all over the country, all over the world. And so he did something very smart politically, you know, putting that big smile on his face.
Well,
I don't think he was trying to say that he was happy to be arrested.
Oh, no, that's not what I meant. I meant what he was trying to do with that big smile also is also stick it to the Democrats.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You can't see, you're not bothering me at all. That was his point. You know, you're not hurting me with this. And I think all that's going to come back and really get him hard within probably 6 months from now or so.
Yeah, well, we'll see.
Hopefully.
it's probably going to be in a court of law that we'll find out, you know, what happens ultimately to Tom DeLay.
We can only hope.
Yeah.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
The rest of your life. These are the memories you'll pack in a box and you'll pull out sometimes. Pick your flowers.
And welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour, we're coming up on it. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Over in the chat room discussion, well, actually, this is interesting. Blue in Missouri notes the House of Representatives is voting on what right now on what to do with 507s. Yeah, good luck. Like the Republicans are going to do anything that actually represents true campaign change. Somehow I doubt it. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Ann in Sarasota, Florida. Hey, Ann, welcome to the program.
Hi, I listen most of the time, don't usually get time to call in. I want to tell you how much I enjoy your show.
Well, thank you.
The reason I'm calling is because I am in Florida. A lot of this discussion about the illegal immigrants does impact me directly.
Sure.
Because our state, we have a lot of migrant workers in our area, and a lot of them are on the local welfare rolls and health care rolls and school, and you know, it does impact us that live here and work here. What I find real interesting was something I read this morning regarding all of these illegal immigrants and all these demonstrations that are going on across the country, because they are very well organized, no matter what they're trying to tell you. Well, what I was reading is that they've been running ads and things for those demonstrations on the Spanish-speaking television and radio networks.
Right.
And what someone did was trace back who owns those stations, and I found out that a majority of them are actually owned by General Electric. Now, we know General Electric is very good at censoring news they don't want on TV, such as when they were having protests against the war in Iraq, et cetera.
Right. That's when GE, which owns MSNBC, took Phil Donahue off the air, even though he was the most highly rated and only profitable program on MSNBC at the time.
Exactly. So we all have to question, why are they allowing all of this to be appear on these Spanish-speaking stations to encourage all of this demonstration?
Yeah,
get all these people out there. I smell a plot. Don't
you? That's interesting. That's interesting. Well, you know, I don't know. It may well be, but maybe not for the reason that you think, Ann. You know, just from inside radio. Okay, I do a morning program before I do this national program on a radio station in Portland, Oregon, KPOJ. It's a 25,000-watt station. It reaches much of the Pacific Northwest, and it's owned by Clear Channel. Clear Channel also distributes about 80% of all the people who listen to progressive talk radio in the United States are listening on a Clear Channel station. And yet, Lowry Mays, I believe, is the president. I think that the Mays family is the second, I may be wrong on this, it might be third or fourth, but they're one of the top five donors to the, you know, over the lifetime to George W. Bush's political career. So you would think that they would say, you know, we don't want to have progressive talk radio, and yet they're the largest distributor of progressive talk radio in the United States. What was made very clear to me when I started doing the program was, you know, as long as you make us money, you know, as long as people are listening, we don't care what you say. It's not about the politics. It's about making money. And you get it that, you know, Vladimir Lenin was right. The definition of a capitalist is the guy who's going to sell you the rope that you're going to use to hang him. And so my take on GE owning the Spanish language stations that are hyping, you know, get out in the streets, get out in the streets, is that that's probably really good for listenership on those stations. And therefore, it makes more money for those stations, and therefore, GE would be in favor of that. And the positive fallout, I suppose, for them is that, you know, more cheap labor for corporate America. But my guess is it's probably being, if it is being promoted at the level of programming, and I frankly don't know, my guess would be it would be being done because it raises listenership.
Well, I have one hole I want to shoot in your theory there.
Okay.
Supposedly 80% of the people now say they're against the war in Iraq. And they've had protests and things, and they've had demonstrations, but you don't see anything hardly at all. It's barely mentioned on the mainstream media about what's going on in those protests. They try to downplay the numbers of people that were there that showed up, things like that.
Right.
They're not giving them the same kind of coverage that they're giving this. I think there's several different motives involved in doing this, but I think it's very interesting what all this discussion is going on about this. It takes the heat off of Bush about the illegal spying, about 9/11 and what Charlie Sheen had to say the other week about, hey, there's a lot of this stuff that doesn't add up in your official version, and we'd like to know more. Mm-hmm. By the way, they did censor that one, and that got stopped. But there's a lot of other things going on that are being ignored because they've got everybody's attention on this, and not that it's not a big issue, because it is, especially if you're living in one of the states that's heavily populated by illegal immigrants.
But you know, in defense of the mainstream media, which I do cringing, okay, but in defense of them, I would say, you know, the anti-war demonstrations, I mean, were well covered back in 2002 when we had the largest demonstrations in the history of the world, people out on the streets. They really were well covered and were well known. The demonstrations that are happening now tend to be relatively small, and I think in the minds of a lot of people in the media, it's more of the same. You know, yes, there's people out there demonstrating, there's always going to be people out there demonstrating, but when a million people show up on the streets, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, it's never happened before. That is news. You know, it's a hot story. So, Ann? Yep, I guess Ann is gone, but yep, she heard the music. And, I'm not yet convinced, let's put it that way, that there's a nefarious agenda at work here, but I wouldn't rule it out. Absolutely wouldn't rule it out. So we'll carry on from there. It's 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. We'll be back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome, my friends. Coming up on today's program, Bill Falzon, U.S. congressional candidate in California's 2nd District. Just on the edge there of Sacramento, where we're on the air, and KSAC is going to be here on our Taking My Country Back segment, and an update on veteran affairs with Larry Scott from VA Watchdog in our 3rd hour. For our 1st hour, are conservatives hell-bent on destroying our schools, or conservatives would say, are liberals? Dr. Dominic Maglio, a neo-traditionalist culture war expert on educational terrorism and how to stop it. Dominic, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me, Tom.
Educational terrorism?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Educational terrorism. What that means to me is that when people are given a position and have a job description, instead of doing what they're supposed to do, for instance, teach a subject matter, they're using their classroom with a captive audience, they're using it as a bully puppet to basically tell people, especially young, impressionable people, what they think about the world. And very often it's skewed, it's unbalanced, it's not fair, it's un-American, and it makes these kids think that really makes them feel that it's that they have no hope in the world, and America has no future. So it's a terroristic act in my mind.
So we should accuse them of terrorism and throw them in Guantanamo Bay?
I think that might be going overboard. But
well, that's what we do to terrorists.
We should fire them because they are not doing their job. And I think we have to have standards in life, and we certainly should have standards in education. It's a government school paid by taxpayers. They're paid to do a job. They should do it. If they're not doing it, if they're just spouting off and they're not doing their job, they should be removed from their particular position.
Dominic Maglio, back in the late 19th century, a guy named Horace Mann, who'd gone over to Germany and seen the Prussian school system at work, a school system that was invented in 1813 in response in large part to Napoleon's having kicked the butt of the Prussian emperor at the time, who then went to Fichte, the leading philosopher in Germany, and said, how do we create an army that can defeat Napoleon? And he said, well, you've got to start with your children. You have to create an entire generation of children who don't who don't question authority. So we will change. We will create a and who feel more committed to the state than they do even to their parents.
Right.
And so we will create a school system that is, number one, compulsory, so they will know that the school, that the state is more powerful than their parents.
Right.
Number two, that they will be required to ask the question, may I ask a question, before they even ask a question, so they will never question authority. Number three, we don't want them to think in a holistic fashion. We don't want them to put A plus B. We don't want them to have big picture thinking. We want them to be thinking, shoot when you see the whites of their eyes.
Right.
So we break the topics into individual segments and teach them separately. And number four, we want them to be sure to be a person who takes orders. So we give drastic punishment if they don't take orders. And Horace Mann came over back to the United States, and by the way, it did create a powerful and marvelous German army. And so Horace Mann came back to the States in the 1880s and 1890s and started pitching this to industry up and down the East Coast, saying, here's the solution to the problem of people not having a good workforce, because so many people on the East Coast were migrating westward that a lot of our factories are having a hard time getting people. And he couldn't get anybody to buy it until in the 1890s, the legislature of Massachusetts, which had been taken over by a secret society, a Protestant secret society called the Order of the Star-Spangled Banner, and they're called the Know-Nothing Congress of Massachusetts that year, because they had this secret handshake and they said, I know nothing. That was their secret, except it wasn't a secret. They were proud of it. They were concerned about the Catholics. All these Catholics were coming in from Ireland, from the potato famine and whatnot, and there were now more Catholics in Massachusetts than there were Protestants, particularly in Boston, and the question was, how do we break the back of the Catholics? And so they decided to use Horace Mann's technique and go into the school and just have kids learn exactly what they were taught, without any dialogue, without any discussion. To hell with the Socratic method. Forget about, children questioning.
Well, I believe in the Socratic method. I believe in getting children to think. I do not think.
This is my point. It sounds to me like you're saying the same thing Horace Mann was saying, which is we're going to have an absolutely uniform educational system teaching what the state wants taught.
You cannot get children to think if they don't know facts. We have to teach children history. We need to teach them. They have to learn. They just can't have someone, what I consider, indoctrinating them. Because
so give me an example of this indoctrination, Dominic Megley.
Indoctrination is what Jay Banish did in Colorado. It's what
give me the example.
Does in the University of Colorado.
Give me one example, please. Let's just talk about a real case incident here.
Jay Banish. Getting
okay, tell me what he did.
Well, I mean, it's pretty well known what he did. He spent 40 minutes lambasting the policies in a geography class of the United States.
Of the Bush administration.
Whatever. It doesn't matter.
Okay. So he was lambasting the Bush administration's policies.
Okay,
and you think kids should be taught
Ford
history
Churchill.
In schools.
Let's
isn't this
Ford
history
Churchill.
In the making?
What? I'm sorry?
Yeah, isn't this history in the making?
No, because he's talking about geography. Not talking. Ward Churchill gets up and he calls 9/11 victims little Eichmanns. These are using.
That was in college.
This is using a captive audience. No. Let me tell you, I taught college for a decade. I have a college preparatory school for the last 23 years. You have a right to discuss things as an open forum where students have a right to have their opinions, and then you have a Socratic method. You ask questions, you open a discussion, you talk about things after they have the facts. But you don't just tell them what to think. Tom, I know you would be against that. You wouldn't want anybody to get up there and start telling everyone they have to believe in Christianity or have to believe in Islamic religion. That's not what we do in America. We have a right to discuss. And if you ever watch Ward Churchill on TV, he doesn't allow his students to rebut what he says. And that's despicable. That's tyranny.
It's also college. And the kids can say, I'm not going to take this class. I'm going to take a different
class.
We're talking with Dominic Megley. What you're really upset about is any teacher who dares.
In high school, he was not in college. Banish did the same thing. No one can speak up because a guy goes off on a tirade. And I'm saying to you, you don't think that's education. That's not guiding anybody. That's telling them what to do. Exactly what you discussed about Horace Mann. I'm saying.
Why, Dominic Megley, are you so terrified of our children being exposed to ideas or opinions that may contradict yours or those of the Bush administration?
No, I think it's great to have opinions contradict, but you have to have a forum to do that. You don't do that as part of a job description to educate children in a particular subject and go off on
Then you think that education should be entirely mechanistic and entirely mechanical, and if somebody is supposed to teach geography, they're just supposed to say, here's where New Mexico is and here's where Arizona is. They're not supposed to offer their own opinions. They shouldn't be saying, this is what I think about something.
Well, you know what? That's real nice. So if someone wants to talk about what they think, go on a soapbox in the middle of 49th Street and start speaking. But if people want to do that, that's fine. When you're getting paid with government tax money, that means citizens' money, they need to do a job. I have tremendous opinions. So do you. You do it in the right forum. You don't, in a school that I'm, I don't go up and tell my students what to think about politics. That's not part of my job, is to educate children. It's to help them learn basic skills.
But what you are arguing is that children should be taught about politics, that they should be taught the official line about politics.
What do you mean?
Just what I said. You're saying that these guys should not be criticizing the Bush administration.
No, I didn't say
to not criticize the Bush administration is to implicitly endorse
ranting.
The Bush administration.
They're ranting. If they make a specific statement, look, there's a lot of things I detest about what's happening in the Bush administration right now. Detest to the utmost of my heart. I think that Bush is an economic internationalist. I do not agree with that, but I think he's been very deceptive about what he's done. I can talk about that, but I'm going to talk about it. Other people have different ways of looking at it, and you have a discussion. You do not take and just dominate and use a classroom as a bully pulpit, because that's terrorism.
So
that's
Dominic
terrorizing
Maglio, our kids. Yeah, I got your point. So are you suggesting then that we should just federalize education so that...
Federalize!
Right now we have a situation where local school boards... Dominic, let me make my point here. We have a situation where local school boards hire and fire teachers. What's wrong with a local school board saying, hey, we don't like the way this guy's teaching, and fire him?
Well, your question is, should an incompetent person be fired? I say yes. Why?
Well, I don't understand why you're trying to make a national issue out of this, unless this is just another, you know, right-wing be afraid thing, because school boards have the ability to fire teachers.
No, I don't agree, first of all, in government schools anyway. I have a private school. I believe that what we have to do, because...
Only people who have money should be able to send their kids to school.
Oh, give me a break. That's not... You're changing yourself. I was talking about people...
Well, you just changed the subject to this.
I'm sorry.
I mean, you just changed the subject to, you know, let's do away with government schools.
No, so, I didn't say that. I said I am not in favor of government schools. I believe I was just speaking on another radio show, and the person said, well, you know, I was talking about bullying. And the person said, well, the administrator couldn't do anything because his hands were tied. And I think that's exactly the problem in government schools. Their hands are tied. We need to have the ability to have free exchange of ideas. That happens better in private education.
Well, Dr. Dominic Maglio, drmaglio.com is website. Thanks for being with us this morning.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Tom.
Good talking with you. Dominic Maglio. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 16 minutes past the hour. We'll be back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
So why are conservatives hell-bent on destroying our schools?
Express yourself!
Yeah, well, that's why, because they don't like it when people express themselves. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on the radio support group of, by, and for we, the people of the United States of America. There's a couple of issues wrapped into this thing. As first of all, you've got conservatives out there who don't think that we should have public education. Now, why are conservatives opposed to public education? You know, sometimes the arguments that they put forward are the ones that I was making about Horace Mann. In fact, the genesis of public education in the United States is not particularly egalitarian, at least modern public education. Horace Mann was trying to create a system where everybody, you know, where everybody would become a good little robot for the factories. But the reality is that if you go back 100 years before Horace Mann to the founders of this country, Thomas Jefferson creating the University of Virginia as a free college for anybody who could go, and communities all across the United States hiring the local school marm and bringing a teacher into town to run the one-room schoolhouse and collectively getting together and everybody digging into their pocket to pay for it, you find that the reason for education, for public education in the United States, is very simple. It's social mobility. And this highlights one of the fundamental differences between conservatives and liberals in the history of this country. The liberals like George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Thomas Paine, James Madison, even to some extent Alexander Hamilton, the liberals who created this country, strongly believed in social mobility. They believed that regardless of the economic or social class into which a person is born, they should have the right and the ability to move into higher economic and social classes. And in fact, that was the case in the United States for many, many years. We were one of the most socially mobile countries in the world. We are now below the United Kingdom, where they actually still have an aristocracy in terms of social mobility. The probability of your being born in poverty in the United States and moving out of poverty is lower than in any other Western country. We are the worst in the world for this. And the key to, you know, one of the primary keys anyway, to moving out of poverty is getting a good education. Now, this works very well for conservatives who believe in a social hierarchy. And that is one of the tenets of conservative thought. And no, this isn't demagoguery. Go back and read Russell Kirk's 1953 book, The Conservative Mind, in which he goes all the way back to the 1700s, the late 1700s, and the arguments that were being, you know, the conservatives at that time, and, you know, all the debates that were being having about what does it mean to be a conservative. And Kirk, you know, comes right out and says, you know, conservatives believe in a social hierarchy. They think it's the natural order of things. And Barry Goldwater was all impressed by that. And the conservatives of the day, William F. Buckley, I mean, constantly talking about Russell Kirk's book. I mean, this was the Bible for the conservative movement, The Conservative Mind, 1953. And if you're going to have a social hierarchy, you can't have social mobility. And you're going to have a ruling elite. And this is one of the reasons, by the way, why Limbaugh and other cons, who are the shock troops of the conservative movement, have been using the phrase elite constantly when they refer to liberals, because they're trying to immunize themselves from the reality that conservatives have been calling for 200 years for there to be an elite ruling America. John Adams believed there should be an elite ruling America. He referred to the average person, the common man, the working person, as the rabble. And felt they should have no play in democracy. They should not have a voice in government. So number one, you have the conservatives who are trying to destroy public education, because public education provides for social mobility. And if you have privatize education, you have a situation just like you have with healthcare right now. If you're a millionaire, no problem. You have access to it, the best you can get. If you're a working stiff, particularly on the low end of the working salary range, you're out of luck. You become one of the 46 million uninsured. You become one of the what would be millions of uneducated if we didn't have a public education system. So number one. Number two, there is this incredible effort underway on the part of conservatives across the United States of political correctness, of trying to scare the hell out of teachers in public schools and say, no, you're not allowed to have an opinion. This is the exact same thing the Nazis did in Nazi Germany. Any teacher who spoke out against Hitler was toast. I mean, in the early years, they were merely fired. Later on, you know, they would face much more draconian measures. They would be called, for example, traitors. Gee, where have I heard that recently? I mean, this is something I think, as Americans, we should be very concerned about, that right-wing talk radio all across America right now is out there pounding on the idea that our teachers are running down America. They're saying anti-American when they're actually saying things that are opposed to the Bush administration policies, number one, and which I think is very pro-American and very patriotic. And number two, we do have local school boards. We do, to a fairly large extent across the United States, still have local control of our schools. And I can tell you, you know, from personal experience, having been the parent of three kids and also being on the board of directors of a school for the last 10 years, that if parents don't like the way school is going, things change. So why do we have demagogues at a national level running around and saying, oh, this is a vital issue. We've got to stop these teachers from speaking out. And they always have two or three anecdotes, right? And you can, I mean, with anything, you can find two or three over-the-top nutcases. But that's, you know, that does not a national movement make. But shutting up teachers, That's what they're trying to do at a national level. I think it's dangerous. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
It's a Christmas way. Wait till Christmas left. So what's left? What's right?
Past the hour. A place where despair is not an option. Get active, my friends. The Tom Hartman Radio Program. That's me. Our quote for the day from John F. Kennedy. Let us think of education as the means of developing our greatest abilities, because in each of us there is a private hope and dream which, fulfilled, can be translated into benefit for everyone and greater strength for our nation. John F. Kennedy. By the way, No Child Left Behind, another part of the assault on public schools, so much so that United States Senator Jim Jeffords left the Republican Party over that thing. Left the Republican Party. Said enough already because of No Child Left Behind. I mean, it was the straw that broke the camel's back, obviously, but and I salute him for that. The only Republican that I've voted for in my lifetime, frankly, Jim Jeffords. And now Bernie Sanders running for his seat. I only mourn that I no longer live in Vermont so I can vote for him. But the 10 years I lived there, I loved it. In any case, the No Child Left Behind law, which sets these, you know, basically the bottom line of the No Child Left Behind law is that instead of teachers putting together tests, you know, writing them up on the Mimeo machine and running them off for free or on a copy machine in the classroom, and saying, okay, kids, fill out this test, you know, and or do the test in the book and fill it out and hand it up to me. Instead of that, the way that it was done when I was a kid, schools now have to go to private corporations. This is part of the privatization of education. They have to go to private corporations, one of which coincidentally happens to be owned by Neil Bush, the president's brother, and buy from those corporations specific educational materials and specific testing materials so that there is a standardization of education in the United States. Our guest's mention of children being taught history brings to mind Hitler's famous comment that the, you know, history is written by the victors. In any case, so we have across the United States children being tested based, you know, via this No Child Left Behind at the cost of hundreds of millions of dollars. In fact, the educational testing business has gone from a relatively small business when Bush came into office to $1 billion a year industry now, a multi-billion dollar a year industry now. Because of No Child Left Behind, school districts are required to buy these tests, and sometimes at very, very absurd prices. And if their kids don't score well, they get punished. Now, the federal government also wants the kids to score well so that Bush can run around and say, see, there's No Child Left Behind. It's working out wonderfully. Well, strangely enough, they've rigged the system. This from the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. Thousands of children in Indiana, and by Krista Stockman, thousands of children in Indiana and millions across the country are not being counted in the federal government's effort to leave no child behind academically, the Associated Press has found. The No Child Left Behind Act, enacted in 2002, is supposed to make sure all students, particularly those most at risk, including minorities, are meeting minimal standards by 2014. But it is precisely the groups the law was meant to target that are most likely to be unaccounted for in the accountability requirements. The law allows states to set their own parameters for how students will be counted after taking state standardized tests. Students must be counted as an entire group in a school or school district, as well as in subgroups such as black students, Hispanic students, or Asian students. But how large the group has to be before it is counted varies from state to state. In Indiana, for example, test scores of 21,650 children, including a third of the state's Hispanic students, were not reported at the state level. Say what? Nationwide, the AP analysis of 2003-2004 enrollment figures found 1.9 million students, about one in every 14, were not counted under the law's racial categories. Minorities were seven times as likely to have their scores not counted as were whites. In Indiana, for example, Hispanics comprised the largest subgroup of 21,650 students excluded under the clause. The test scores of about 34% of the 8,793 Hispanic students enrolled in Indiana schools were excluded from the scores, the test scores at the school level. Blacks represented the second largest group. About 8% of black enrollment was not reported. Nationally, the AP found that Hispanics and blacks have roughly 10% of their scores excluded. More than a third of Asian scores and nearly half of Native American scores are not broken out either. Less than 2% of white scores are not broken out. So the mechanism by which they count the success of No Child Left Behind is rigged. I mean, it's done just like the Ohio elections. And then there was a fascinating study done by a group in Oregon. They looked at Oregon, and because Oregon has a lot of rural school districts, and because we've got a really funky way of funding schools in the state of Oregon, one school district might spend $12,000 per student per year, another school district might spend $8,000 per school district per year. And some are rich and some are poor, and some have high educational backgrounds among their parents, and some have low, and some represent racial minorities and some don't. And so they said, oh, this is a great place where we can do a test. And so they compared financial resources of the parents, financial resources of the community, poverty, community education levels. They compared these criteria along with how much money per student gets spent in 132 small and rural districts in the state of Oregon. And guess what they found? Quoting from the report in the Oregonian written by Steve Carter, money has the highest correlation of four factors that showed an influence on student achievement. In other words, the amount of money that you spend per child is going to be the biggest factor that's going to determine how that child's going to do. Not how rich their parents are, not how well-educated their parents are, not whether their parents are white or black, not whether they came from a good part of town or a poor part of town, not whether the community is wealthy or poor, not whether there's a lot of immigrants or not, not what their first language was. No, the amount of money per student that you spend is going to be the biggest variable that's going to determine the quality of the education as measured by the competence of that child when they graduate from school. Pure and simple. Second most important influence on achievement, Johnson said, was teacher quality, as measured by whether the teachers had emergency or provisional teaching credentials versus actual credentials in an actual field. All over America, right-wing talking points are being exploded by this study. I suspect you will not hear about it on right-wing talk radio. The average difference between high-achieving and low-achieving rural school districts in Oregon, $1,625 per student. In other words, those districts that paid the extra $1,600 per student per year had the highest student scores in the state, and those who didn't pay the extra $1,625 per student per year had the lowest achieving students per state, and it had nothing to do with any of the other variables. Well, it had something to do. You know, they had some influence, but it really boiled down to, in education, you get what you pay for. What a surprise. And you've got cons running around. You know, they would be the first to say, well, I'm driving this fancy car because you get what you pay for. Well, I bought a fancy new house because you get what you pay for. Well, I want to have the very best clothes because you get what you pay for. This is a conservative mantra. What about education? Oh, no. Got nothing to do with class size. That just makes it more expensive, but that's not going to change education. Nonsense. Conservatives are simply hell-bent to destroy public education in the United States, pure and simple, number one, because it does allow for social mobility, which threatens conservative elites. And number two, they don't want our children to have critical thinking skills. They don't want our children to grow up to be adults who might question authority, because questioning authority is not something conservatives do. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Joshua in Fulton, Mississippi. Hey, Joshua, welcome to the program.
How you doing, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better, Joshua. What's up?
Not much. When I was in high school, I'm 25 now. I'm a college graduate, own my own business. And, excuse me?
Yeah, no, I'm listening.
Okay. Anyway, my senior year in high school, we had state government, economics, stuff like that. And, mm-hmm. and our teacher proposed, he showed us all different forms of government, from dictatorships to republic to democracy, all the way down to, you know, communism, everything. He said, which one of these is the best form of government? And I said, even though it's not the best in theory, communism would work. Because everyone's on an equal playing field, and there's no haves or have-nots.
Mm-hmm.
And with a democracy. A democracy is looking after the entire group, not just a certain part of the demographic.
Mm-hmm.
He was a Republican. I knew he was a Republican. After class, he took me to the principal and the counselor and told him I was trying to disrupt class.
So this happens on both sides, huh?
Oh, right. Yeah, exactly. You know, I said, no, I was stating my opinion.
Right.
But, you know, we're in the South. It's very, very conservative.
Right.
And
how dare you advocate for communism or socialism? Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing.
I was saying, you know, I said, the Republic, what really made him mad, the Republic's nothing but a lot form of a dictatorship.
Mm-hmm.
And that blew him over. He hated that.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to argue the politics of it with you, Joshua. I think it's a fascinating story, though. Thanks a lot for sharing it with us.
I appreciate it.
That's interesting. 1-866-440-8466. Patricia in Sacramento, listening on KSAC. Hey, Patricia.
Hey, Tom. Hey, Tom, did you notice on your last guest, when you asked him, he made a comment about, well, I prefer private school, and you said, well, does that mean only people with money get educated? He didn't seem like he wanted to respond.
No, he didn't.
I just thought that was so interesting, because
yeah.
That's how a lot of conservatives react to that question. But, you know, I agree with you 100%, and it's so important to have a society where everyone it has the ability to be educated. I mean, it pulls people out of poverty. Crime goes down. I mean, there's so many, you know, benefits that go to this. But I wanted to add to this by saying I went to CSU Monterey Bay, which was a really progressive university, and I had, you know, a mixture of, we had some conservative professors, like in economics, and you know what? I've never had a problem with having debate in the class.
Yeah.
They allowed any type of debate. They gave you your opinion because we wanted to know what their opinion is.
And that's what you want. I mean, that's the American ideal, is that we listen to all opinions and we have a discussion of it. Patricia, thanks so much for sharing that with us. Great talking with you. It's 45 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, please, Harry.
Things are looking bad. I know you would be mad to see your favorite man. Never found the land you love.
Indeed, we so need Harry Truman again. Good old Harry. I never gave anybody hell. I just told them the truth, and they thought it was hell. Harry Truman, the first president of the United States to introduce a national health care program, a single-payer national health care program. Rejected by the Republicans in the House and the Senate in 1946. Amazing. Welcome back to our program, Public Education, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Brad in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Brad, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great. What's up?
I was looking on the web last night, and I saw three different articles about this, all repeating the same thing, and then I heard you say it, and I had to call in. The way that the reporting guidelines work for minority groups in school, everybody's scores get reported. Okay, but if there's literally, say, for example, one African-American family in a school of 200 or 300 kids, that African-American family doesn't get broken out into a separate racial subcategory. Those 3 or 4 or 5 kids' scores still get reported. They still count. Okay, so if they're still doing it, they're doing poorly, they're going to pull down the school's average. The trick is, the last school I was at, for example, almost entirely Latino and white. We literally had one black family, 3 kids. All 3 of those kids were adopted. All 3 of those kids had major learning difficulties. If their scores had been broken out into a separate racial category for African-American students, our school would have been labeled failing because it's 3 kids out of 180. No Child Left Behind is a lot of stuff wrong. It's a bad law on a number of levels, but that particular thing is not one of them.
Oh, that's interesting. So the reason why these kids are not counted is to try to prevent the problem of statistical anomalies.
Precisely. And again, you know, this is the problem, is I keep hearing people say they're not counted. That's not true. They are counted. They count against the average of the school as a whole. They count as much as any other individual kid or any other four or five kids in the building.
Well, my position on all this, Brad, is that we shouldn't be doing this at a federal level anyway.
Absolutely not.
That we should have local control of schools. That I can't believe in my wildest imaginings that some bureaucrat in Washington D.C. or even some elected politician who has everybody's best interest at heart is going to care as much about how my kid does in my local public school as I do. Brad, your phone line has gone flaky here, but good point. Thanks a lot for educating us on this. Steve in Tampa Bay, Florida. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hi. I'm just trying to figure out, I just don't understand how the Republicans get around the common sense logic of public education. The more educated somebody is, the more money they make in their job.
Well, that's what they will tell you.
The more taxes they pay, the more money there is for education. And more Republicans.
They're viewing it as a zero-sum game, Steve. They're viewing it as there's only a certain number of people who can really make it into the top 5% or the top 2% of wage earners. And, there's a limited demand for a limited number of doctors or engineers or whatever. And, in fact, that top pool is shrinking because now we've figured out ways to export those jobs. And so they want to make sure that it's their kids who are in there, not yours or mine.
Okay, well, that makes sense.
It's really fairly straightforward. And then the scam is they say, and the way that we should do it is with vouchers. What we're going to do is we're going to get everybody a $2,000, $2,500 was the last number I heard for one of the voucher programs that was, introduced at the federal level. We're going to get everybody a $2,500 voucher. Well, the average cost to educate a student in the United States is around $7,000-$8,000. And here in Oregon, it was around $9,000. And so a cheap private school is $7,000 or $8,000. I mean, a really down and dirty cheap private school that's doing a decent job, $7,000 or $8,000. So if you've got a $2,000 voucher, you can't afford to take your kids out of public school and come up with an additional $5,000. But on the other hand, if you're one of the wealthy elite and you already have your child in a private school, that $2,000 voucher becomes a $2,000 gift from the government for having put your child in a private school, which of course is what the whole voucher program is about. It's about paying off the wealthy elite or helping them out to make sure that their kids get whatever education they want and making it look like they're doing something to help education.
Oh, there's still a logical flaw there, though, that just because you get more education, there are other jobs out there that don't involve necessarily being an engineer or a doctor. I have a degree in sciences and became a scientific consultant. Nothing to do with being a doctor or a lawyer. It's a homegrown United States-type job.
The reality is that the vast majority of the workforce of the United States historically has been blue collar, and now increasingly is pink collar, is service workers. It's not the quote white collar jobs. So that's where college education usually comes in white collar. I mean, I'm radically oversimplifying, but I would suggest to you that the reason conservatives want to destroy public education is because they really and truly do believe in a caste system. And they don't do it out of some evil intent. They really believe that the most stable society is a society that is run by a ruling elite that knows best. It's a variation on the concept of noblesse oblige. That those born into nobility have an obligation to take care of the rest of us, and they really know what's best, and they teach their children what's best, and the whole thing. And you see this right across the board. I mean, this was sort of how Joe Kennedy raised his kids as well. You have an obligation. And for them, for Jack and for Bobby and Teddy, that meant, go into public service and really defend the majority of the people. But for most conservatives, the concept of noblesse oblige means, like Bill Frist, his daddy's a billionaire, so he has to go out and promote the interests of billionaires.
In recorded history, has that ever worked out?
Oh, sure. It's a very stable form of government. It's called feudalism. Europe stayed that way for thousands of years. Japan was that way for thousands of years. China was that way for thousands of years. It is, and this is the conservatives will tell you, it is the most stable form of government. It's just not the most free. So, Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. I talk about that, frankly, at length in two books that I've written, Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights, and What Would Jefferson Do? A Return to Democracy. Actually, and also the comic book that I did, We the People, Call to Take Back America. They all talk about that, how the conservatives really are. What they're really calling for is neo-feudalism, return to feudalism. And they're doing it out of, in my opinion, good intentions. It's just not the way that we want to live. 57 minutes after the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Our quote for the day from Abraham Lincoln: better remain silent and be thought a fool than to speak out and remove all doubt. Well, I'm not sure that's the best quote for a talk show host here, David. let me toss a couple of my favorites in for the day here. Franklin Roosevelt: conservative is a man who has two perfectly good legs, who, however, has never learned how to walk forward. And George Washington: as mankind becomes more liberal, they will be more apt to allow that all those who conduct themselves as worthy members of the community are equally entitled to the protections of civil government. I hope ever to see America among the foremost nations of justice and liberality. One of the protections of civil government that George Washington suggests all worthy members of the community should be equally entitled to is, in the minds of a lot of people these days, access to the Internet. Unfettered access to the Internet, uncontrolled by corporate interests. David Tebow is with us. He's with CNSNews.com, the conservative cybercast news service, CNSNews.com, their website. And, David, I've been getting emails from what seem to me to be AstroTurf groups saying, protect our Internet from government regulation. But you look at them, and it's just got AT&T's fingerprints all over it. What am I missing here?
What are you missing about control of the Internet?
Well, first of all, I'm assuming that I'm right, that these conservative, end quote, groups that are saying that are opposed to net neutrality and saying, you know, keep the government out of control of the Internet. Really what they don't want is they don't want the government controlling AT&T. Right?
This issue is going to be decided on whether you believe in the free market. And whether you believe that the government ultimately needs to regulate it, because not only is it a free market, but the abundance of smut and filth on the Internet needs to be regulated.
Okay, well, these two separate issues here. Let's take the second one first, just because I think we can dispose of it very quickly. There's a guy who has proposed a .xxx domain. And his suggestion is, and this is a free market solution, actually. He wants to make money on this thing. And his solution is, just require by law, anything that's pornographic has to be in .xxx. And that way, it'll be very easy to filter. Public libraries can say, sorry, you can't go there. It'll be just like the movies. You know, you're under 17, you can't get in.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, that just seems to me like a reasonable thing. I can turn him down. But I think that's a good idea. I'm assuming you agree with me on that.
Yeah, and you know, you've got a very liberal Democrat, Ed Markey, proposing this legislation, the Network Neutrality Act of 2006. So, you know, I think that this is an issue that isn't going to necessarily be split along conservative and liberal lines, but it's going to be split along the lines of people who are absolutely 100% free market and people who believe that in some cases, some circumstances, you need some regulation.
So let's get back to that issue then, because, you know, as I said, I think that pornography versus free market are really, we need to separate those two issues, and we can agree that one way to deal with pornography is simply to establish a domain that it all has to go to.
Right.
And that's something that, you know, I think progressives and conservatives can agree on. But the issue really is, in fact, let me just give you a little background. Back in the 80s, I used to run a bunch of forums for CompuServe, and this was back when CompuServe was owned by the big a tax company, H&R Block, and based out of Columbus, Ohio. And, you know, we'd go to these annual meetings. And I remember the annual meeting that we went to, one of the ones where they introduced HTML. And they said, this is going to revolutionize, you know, there's this thing called the Internet, right? Or the World Wide Web, you know, because at that point there was the Internet, but there wasn't the World Wide Web. There was the Internet, and there was CompuServe, and there was AOL, and Lexis and Nexus and things like that. And you had to be a geek to use it. I was one of those geeks using it. This was in the mid-'80s. And then the web came along, and I remember one of the meetings that I was at in toward the late 90s, where they said, we have the ability, now this was after AOL took over CompuServe, might have been the early 90s, they said, we have the ability with our switches to set it up so if somebody's accessing the web through their AOL account, that we can cause a page to load from some, depending on the domain name server, from some, you know, locations, really fast or really slow. And it has nothing to do with how fast or slow it would normally load. We can simply control that. And so we can go to Disney, for example, and say, hey, you guys pay us $100,000 a year, and we'll have your pages load faster than anybody else's. And there was a debate within the company about that, and I was part of that debate. And ultimately they decided not to do it because the blowback from consumers would be so heavy. That's basically what this is all about. Net neutrality. Basically what's happened is AT&T and Verizon, a couple of companies, by coincidence of the nature of the communications infrastructure in the United States, most of which is going through public rights of way, and by coincidence of the existence of the Internet, which was brought into existence by the government, we have these two things that are very much part of the public, and now you've got private corporations saying, oh, we want to control that. You have AT&T saying, we should be able to do like that conversation that we had back 15 years ago. We should be able to say, oh, well, if Disney pays us $1 million a year, we'll make sure that their pages load lickety-split. And if CNS News doesn't, then your pages are going to take 2.5 seconds to load.
Right.
And why are the conservatives saying this is how it should be, this is the free market? This isn't a free market. This got nothing to do with the free market. AT&T owns the pipes.
It all comes down to politics, Tom. And you know that everything with regard to Internet access, broadband, speed is going to come back to the political message that every website, or the cultural message that every website distributes. You know, it's not a neutral issue. Let's face it, net neutrality is not a neutral issue.
Oh, wait a second.
There are going to be judgment calls.
Let's split these issues up here, David, because perhaps either I'm missing something or you're missing something, because it seems to me that our understanding of this agreement of this issue is not an agreement, and I don't think that we can take positions on it unless we agree on what we're talking about. The ability of an Internet service provider to charge, for example, my website, tomhartman.com, I'm charged based on the amount of stuff I have sitting on their servers. I'm charged based on how much of that stuff gets streamed out to the world. You know, people are downloading a lot of video. It's going to cost me more money. If somebody hooks up to the web and they want to watch, you know, video content or whatever, if they're taking it off Usenet, for example, you know, there's providers that charge by the gigabyte. Some of your broadband providers right now, some of your cable providers and DSL providers are starting to say, okay, you can have up to, you know, 30 gigs a month or whatever, but after that, you're going to have to pay extra. I have no problem with any of that, because that all has to do with basically the more you're using the service, the more you're going to pay for it. But in the middle, there are these major giant pipelines that are an infrastructure that was put there by government, that was built by government. It happens to be administered right now by private companies. But this website infrastructure came about as a consequence of government activity. And AT&T wants to be able to say, because they own that infrastructure in the middle,
right,
that at the level of the highways, they can discriminate. It's like being able to say, okay, we're going to privatize a freeway. We're going to privatize Route 80 going across the United States. But anybody who drives a Volkswagen, we're going to put a device on their wheel that causes their car to go 10 miles an hour slower than everybody else.
Well, I think that we are understanding the same issue, but I'm submitting to you, Tom, when you're talking about the reasons why they might discriminate. Let me ask you, do you think that there might be some possibility that they might discriminate against your website because of the content of your website?
No, I think this is all about money.
Well,
they could equally come against your website. I just don't think they're going to do that. I don't think they're going to go there.
Has
has Google discriminated with regard to the ads that it's willing to post? Has Yahoo discriminated with regard to the ads that it's been willing to post?
Well, those are all financial transactions. I mean, I have Google ads on my website, and I can say I don't want particular domains to show up.
I know that conservatives have been upset about both Google and Yahoo, even AOL.
Yeah, but we just have a minute here left, David. It sounds to me like you're not supportive of the conservative position that AT&T should control the web rather than we the people through the government.
I believe that the free market is going to have to determine it, but I
which is going to mean AT&T because they own the pipes.
If you own the pipes and you've done so legally, then I think you ought to have the right to control.
But they own the pipes by virtue of our giving that control to them. Shouldn't we be able to have some say in how those are used?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that that ultimately this is going to come down to content and not about speediness or about the hardware.
Interesting.
I think it's always going to be about content.
That's interesting. See, I having been inside the business, I just don't think so. But, well, we'll see how it shakes out. David, good talking with you. David Tebow, CNSnews.com. Have a great morning. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program. New decision from the Supreme Court. More on that right after this.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartmann.
Too late to fight, it's too late to change. You may be wrong, but all I know, but you may be right.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann here with you, the Tom Hartmann radio program, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. And occasionally a decent, clean election, free of the influence of a corporation and its voting machines. Okay, here's this case that just came down before the Supreme Court. And the, trying to find the title of the case. I had it, David. Thank you. Garcetti versus Sabalos. Garcetti versus Sabalos. And in this case, the Supreme Court basically just said that 20 million public employees, 20 million employees of the United States do not have free speech rights to disclose the government's inner workings. This is, and it's interesting who ruled on this thing. It was, this is particularly interesting. All five of the, well, arguably Kennedy is a conservative, but he's not a foaming-at-the-mouth conservative. But the five conservative Catholic members of the court, Kennedy, Scalia, Thomas, Alito, and Roberts, all ruled, essentially, that if a person in the practice of their job points out the wrongdoing, in this case, it was a deputy sheriff. It was a prosecutor. Excuse me. It was prosecutor Richard Cabellos was his name. This guy in Los Angeles. He was in the L.A. District Attorney's Office. And he wrote a memo in which he suggested that a county sheriff's deputy might have lied in order to get a search warrant. And as a result of his outing this county sheriff's deputy, Cabellos got trash. He according to his lawsuit, he was demoted and denied a promotion. And oddly, in this case, Garcetti versus Cabellos, the five conservative members of the court, Scalia, Thomas, Alito, Roberts, and Kennedy, argued that The First Amendment doesn't apply. You don't have First Amendment protections. You don't even have whistleblower protections when you're doing your official duty. This is where it's really weird. If your job is to point out official wrongdoing, you have no protections when you do your job. No, I know it sounds totally wacko, but that's what... here it is. The court says, when public employees... This is, I'm reading from the decision. When public employees make statements pursuant to their official duties, the employees are not speaking as citizens for First Amendment purposes, and therefore the Constitution does not insulate their communication from employer discipline. Now, on the other hand, the court appears to have said that if your job is not to catch wrongdoing and you point out wrongdoing, you may still have some protections. And Justice Kennedy, he calls this a doctrinal anomaly. And he says, employees who make public statements outside the course of performing their official duties retain some possibility of First Amendment protection because that is the kind of activity engaged in by citizens who do not work for the government. He talks about this is the same thing as writing a letter to the editor of a local newspaper. He also says, if a government employer is troubled by this perceived anomaly, it has the means at hand to avoid it. A public employer that wishes to encourage its employees to voice concerns privately retains the option of instituting internal policies and procedures that are receptive to employee criticism. In other words, a government agency can basically say, okay, we're going to have somebody, and this is my read of this, and this is really early, and I'm not a lawyer, okay, but this is my take on this thing. What they're saying is that a government agency can have within it somebody whose job is to make sure that the government agency is not corrupt. And if they point that out, the government then has the right to say, okay, we're going to can your butt for that. You're going to be in trouble for having done your job because we really don't like what you said. This is the dream decision for the Bush administration. So you've got, the attorney general's, well, not even the attorney general. You've got one of the congressional oversight arms. You've got one of the internal oversight arms. Any kind of oversight of government. Anybody who's doing oversight of government. The conservatives on the court have now said, if your job is oversight of government, catching wrongdoing, and you do it, you can be punished for that. It's absolutely bizarre. Now, this case was argued twice. The first time it was argued was when Justice O'Connor was on the bench. And apparently, it was 5-4 the other way. And then she retired, and Justice Roberts, as Chief Justice, said, we're going to hear this again. And, only this time with me and with Alito and Scalia, and, we're going to hear this again. And now it's 5-4 the other way. This is in my opinion, the erosion of the right to a transparent government. This is, more power in the executive branch. We'll get back on a little bit more on that. A lot of other stuff in the news. I want to get back to net neutrality. Why are the con Christians against the .xxx domain and more in just a minute, 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
I believe in love and I live my life accordingly. But I choose to let the mystery be. Everybody's wondering why and where they all came from. Everybody's wondering about where.
And welcome back. There you go, 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where reason is our lifestyle choice. I'm reading the dissent here by Justice Souter, joined with Justice Stevens and Justice Ginsburg. Against the decision that was just handed down by the five conservative members of the court, Kennedy, Roberts, Thomas, Scalia, and Alito, that if a public employee speaks, that they don't have First Amendment free speech protections. And if their job is catching malfeasance, bad actions, that they're not protected for that. And in the dissent, here Justice Souterie starts out, the court holds that when public employees make statements pursuant to their official duties, the employees are not speaking as citizens for First Amendment purposes, and the Constitution does not insulate their communications from employer discipline. I respectfully disagree. I would hold that the private and public interests in addressing official wrongdoing and threats to health and safety can outweigh the government's stake in the efficient implementation of policy. See, what this comes down to is, do you want the trains to run on time, have the government nice and efficient, but no free speech? Which is the position that was taken by the five conservative members of the court. Or do you want to say, no, we would like to hear from people who are also public employees? And I think maybe we've found the thing that might have flipped this and caused the conservatives to go aggressively in this direction. And it might even have something in some small way to do with the fact that it's the Catholics, the five Catholics on the court who all voted for this. And that is that this may tie in somehow to abortion and education. In his dissent, Justice Souter writes, this ostensible domain beyond the pale of the First Amendment, in other words, this area that they have carved out, where if you're a public employee and you're doing your job and you say something that your employer doesn't like, you can be harassed, you can be demoted, you can be fired, even though it's your job to say that. That's what he's talking about when he says this ostensible domain beyond the pale of the First Amendment. In other words, you don't have First Amendment rights. He says this ostensible domain beyond the pale of the First Amendment is spacious enough, right? It's big enough, to include even the teaching of a public university professor. And I have to hope that today's majority does not mean to imperil First Amendment protection of academic freedom in public colleges and universities whose teachers necessarily speak and write, quote, pursuant to official duties, end quote. This decision could be the first step in trying to shut down college professors like Ward Churchill, for example, who say things that the right doesn't like to hear. He goes on to, in his dissent, this is David Souter. Keep in mind, David Souter, the lifelong Republican appointed by George Bush's father to the Supreme Court. David Souter says, are prosecutors' discretionary statements about cases addressed to the press on the courthouse steps made pursuant to their official duties? Are government's nuclear scientists' complaints to their supervisors about a colleague's improper handling of radioactive materials made pursuant to their duties? See, the reason he asks these questions is because if they are, then by pointing out, by, you know, a prosecutor saying something that somebody up above him in the food chain, in the power structure, the government power structure doesn't like, they can step on him. Nuclear scientist blowing the whistle, he can be stepped on. And in fact, this was a whistleblowing case. This was a case where a prosecuting attorney said that cop lied when he got that search warrant. And the power structure in L.A. County didn't like that, and they punished that prosecuting attorney. And he said, wait a minute, I've got a First Amendment right of free speech. I can say things without being punished in the workplace for them. And the Supreme Court just ruled today, 5-4 decision, the five conservatives on the court, voting as a block, ruled, no, sorry, you don't have a First Amendment right of free speech. So we have that on the table. Also, we have net neutrality on the table. You know, a lot of interesting things here. Let's take your calls, your thoughts on this. Rachel in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Rachel, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, hi, Tom. This is on the topic, I suppose, almost of net neutrality. I'm looking at a CNET report from May 12th of this month, and the headline says, Adult Industry Welcomes .XXX Domain Rejection, and it goes on to describe that conservative lobbying groups headed by the Family Research Council, which incidentally is the conservative James Dobson group, lobbied heavily to get the XXX domain rejected against the wishes of Europe. Europe really wanted this XXX domain to keep pornography off Main Street.
Right.
So
I wanted to ask your guest previously how he would explain away this lobbying effort by conservative groups.
Well, apparently he wouldn't. I mean, it seemed to me that David Tebow was in agreement with me on this, although I'm not absolutely certain. next time we get him on, you can give us a call and let him know. If you have a call, anytime, Rachel, you or any of our other listeners, if you have a specific question for one of our guests, be sure and let Dan know, who answers the phone there at Air America New York, that you have a question for the guest, and he'll, on my call screen software, he'll put Q for the guest or words to that effect. So, and sometimes we have guests who don't like to take questions from callers, but very often they will, and I think David probably more often than not would, so we'll pass those along. Rachel, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Phil in Tampa Bay, Florida. Hey, Phil.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, what's up?
Let me get off the... Listen, there's an issue here. You know how disenfranchised voters were prevented from voting in Florida elections here, mostly black folks and
yeah,
folks.
Not just Florida. Ken Blackwell threw 300,000 people off the voter rolls in Ohio just in time for the 2004 election.
Right. Well, ChoicePoint was the brilliant company that not only sold people's Social Security numbers and credit cards to hundreds and thousands or millions of people by mistake, gone unpunished for that, but ChoicePoint was supposed to go through this list, okay,
right,
or the state of Florida, to do a better job and not exclude people who are arrested for misdemeanors or whatever.
Actually, yeah, it was ChoicePoint that was doing it, but Catherine Harris, they came back and they said, okay, if we use the exact match criteria, you've got maybe 50 people that we're going to take off the list. And she said, well, loosen up the criteria then. Make it so that it's a similar name. Make it so it's a similar address. Make it, you know, an awful lot of this was not so much ChoicePoint's fault as it was Catherine Harris.
Okay, but
she was defining the criteria.
Yeah, she's not in state government. This is all on Jeb now.
Yeah.
Jeb says that...
Well, Catherine Harris was just doing what Jeb was telling her to do.
Right. Well, she's out of state government. Jeb Bush said that they were going to go through the list and correct it so that everybody who was entitled to vote.
Right.
Could
and in
vote.
Fact, by law, they were required to in time for the 2004 election, and they didn't meet it.
Yeah. Well, bottom line is he hasn't done it yet.
Yep, I know.
And if he ought to be arrested for obstruction of justice.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, Phil, at all. Not at all. And I got to move along. Dave in Cortland, New York. Hey, Dave.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Tom. I just listened to you about the Supreme Court, the decision, and I just see it as another stick used to beat down public safety unions.
You know, that would make a whole lot of sense, Dave.
Yeah.
This is the Garcetti case here.
You know, if I go out and speak on behalf of my union and say I don't have enough equipment for my guys, or if I say I don't have enough people to go on calls with my people.
Are you a firefighter?
You know, yeah, I am. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we constantly struggle with staffing and getting enough people on the fire ground early to make a difference in the fire.
Yeah.
And if I were to go to my taxpayers and say, you know, we wanted to add a couple of staff and the city didn't want me to do that, and I'm doing it on behalf of the union, I could see where they could come after me. And under this decision, I wouldn't have much of a leg to stand on.
Well, it seems, and again, this is just first blush, and I've read a piece of the decision, and I've read most of the dissent, and I've read a couple of commentaries on it. So with that caveat, and the fact that I'm not an attorney or a constitutional scholar, okay, so this is the layman's opinion.
Oh,
but it seems that what they're saying is that you would still have free speech rights, Dave, unless your job was to look for wrongdoing, or your job was to determine how much material you need for your firefighters. If your job was to determine how much material you need for your firefighters and you spoke out and said we need more material, then you could be punished, oddly enough.
Right. Yeah. So. Okay. Yeah, I'm not management, so I don't know if that would be in my job description. So.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a very bizarre one. This is a decision that just, from my point of view, just seems to be spinning hard to the right, very, very hard to the right. Ron in Bennington, Vermont. Hey, Ron, we have about a half a minute left.
Yeah, I was calling just that it's awful the way the Supreme Court is so, so far to the right. I mean, it's not just this here decision. It's basically the Supreme Court who installed George Bush, and they recently passed this law that says if you become a handicapped that you're still required to allow your fixed income of disability pay back student loans, and they're just like their decisions is extremely right.
Yeah. I think that what we're looking at, Ron, thank you very much for the call and for the point. I think that we're looking at the 1905 court all over again, the Lochner court. In 1905, there was this case, it was called the Lochner case, that involved bakers in New York. And well, I'll tell you about it after the break. I think this is the same kind of turning point. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Wake up and shake it up, America. From north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea. Our government is a fight for we, the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow carefully.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here on the program where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say no. Not a chance. No way. 1-866-440-8466-440-THOM, our telephone number, toll-free all across the United States. Will in Orange County, California. Hey, Will.
Hey, Truth Teller. How you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better, Will. What's up?
Really cool. I had a quick question. Well, I don't know how quick. I was wondering, is there any laws that are in place, or is there any way we would have the ability to go ahead and change this stuff that they're throwing into place? It's like they're finally throwing in the last couple of cards of their stacked deck for the next generation of screwing us. We all know it, and we all see it. This is war that they made up.
Okay, sorry, Will, and we can't use language like that on the radio. The bottom line, though, let me get back to the Lochner decision, the Lochner court. This 1905 decision. In 1905, there was a case. The bread makers had a law. They actually got a law passed in the state of New York that said that you couldn't work more than 10 hours a day, 5 days a week, making bread. And it was a way of trying to limit the amount of labor available for the marketplace so that the price of labor would go up. And it was the law. And in 1905, it went before the Supreme Court, and the state Supreme Court had upheld it. It went before the United States Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court said, no, this is an illegal interference in a contract between an employer and an employee. And therefore, any law that says that there's a maximum number of hours a person can work or a minimum wage, I mean, that wasn't specifically part of Lochner, it came a little bit later, but or limits on child labor, limits on number of days that can be worked, limits, any kind of limits at all, are unconstitutional. And from 1905 to 1937, you basically had what's sometimes referred to as the Lochner Court. You had this court that was making these extreme right-wing decisions. And it wasn't until after Franklin Roosevelt had been in office for, 4 years, 5 years, 1937, 32 to 37, or 33, 4, 5, 6, 7, yeah, 4 years, that the court changed and started agreeing with Roosevelt and started going along with the will of the people and saying, okay, well, I guess unions are okay. Okay, I guess it's okay to have, you know, maximum hour laws and all that kind of thing. And it just, that's what it took. And I think that we have just witnessed, with regard to the Supreme Court, we have just witnessed the first shot in the turning point. And the turning point being that we are moving back into the Lochner era. We're moving back to a right-wing Supreme Court, an extremist right-wing Supreme Court. Dave in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Dave.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just thinking that some of the language that you were saying in the decision of the majority on this case has far-reaching ramifications that may go even to some of the lawsuits regarding the NSA spying scandal and whether people have the right to challenge the government from positions within the government, and also even to challenge some of the national security letters that people are getting to silence their investigations.
Yes, if my reading of this is right, and not just mine, I mean, if the broad reading, I mean, there seems to be a consensus about what it means, and certainly the dissenters, the members of the Supreme Court, if their reading of the case is right, then it would seem that somebody whose official capacity was to find wrongdoing. In other words, if there's somebody inside the NSA whose job is to make sure that the NSA doesn't break the law, and there are lawyers inside the NSA who, for example, advised Michaels that he should not be doing the wiretap thing. If there are lawyers inside the NSA who are saying no, you shouldn't do it, and the NSA decides to punish them, they can do it now.
And the same thing would be true for a company like AT&T or Verizon that would fire an employee that questions them giving their information to the NSA without a warrant?
I don't know. This seems to be limited to public employees. Here's the actual phrase that the court used. When public employees, that's, you know, employees of government, make statements pursuant to their official duties, the employees are not speaking as citizens for First Amendment purposes, and the Constitution does not insulate their communications from employer discipline. That's the key sentence in the decision. So I don't think that this yet applies to private employees, but that'll come down the road.
Well, I'm concerned because I know a lot of national security letters going out to people that follow maybe news stories or people within and outside the government and private practice and private business that might be investigating or going into lines of reason that get into national security issues, and they're prevented from telling anybody they've even gotten the letter in the first place.
That's right.
And so I'm thinking that you know, if they were to challenge that and they were in a position within the government, that this new ruling would negate them being able to challenge it at all.
It may be. I I'm not an expert on this stuff, and I'm not an attorney. I don't know. But it's an interesting question to raise, and over the next 24 hours, I'm sure that a lot of these questions will be answered. Dave, got to move along. Thank you for the call. Tom in Buffalo. Hey, Tom, we have a little less than a minute to go. What's up?
I was just talking and thinking that maybe this is a way to silence the unions at a local level. Because
the public employee unions, I would think, yes.
Yeah, well, exactly. The public employee unions like police and firefighters. Who else speaks out on matters of public safety and health if it's not the local union leaders? Other than people that are hired to watch for wrongdoing and oversight of different departments, the local unions at that level are the ones that really have more to say about public safety and health than anyone else. And
yeah.
If you silence them and the manning and the staffing for police and fire, I believe that, like that my brother firefighter from Cortland, I believe that he is right, that they're trying to silence the rank-and-file firefighters.
I don't disagree with you, Tom. And if they don't do it with this decision, they'll figure out another way to do it. This is what I said about Sam Alito when he was first being interviewed. Over and over and over again, Sam Alito, in answer to the questions when he was being interviewed, you saw the same thing with John Roberts. These guys, having grown up being, you know, privileged, white, rich guys, have no sense of what it's like to see a cop car down the street and feel your heart drop, to worry about somebody from the government breaking into your home or listening to your phone conversations. They just have no sense of what it's like to be a minority in the United States, a significant, an oppressed minority. They have no sense of what it's like to be somebody who may be a victim of government power. Not an enemy, but a victim. They have no sense. Eric Bohler coming up next on how the news media failed to be a watchdog.
Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.